The hour of 10 o'clock being here with Skip the Government Operations Committee called to order. And do we have a quorum? Looks like we do.
Yes.
We don't have the minutes? Don't have the minutes done yet, so we'll do those next Tuesday. So I don't have the approval of minutes. The first bill on our agenda for today is House File 409, and Representative Norton is here. And just so people have a roadmap of what we're going to go today, I'd like to get this, well, hopefully we can get this out of here today, but at about 11 o'clock, between 11:05 and 11:10, we're going to, if this bill's not done, we're going to lay it over for, take it up next Tuesday, and then we're going to go to the House File 155. So that's where we're at today. So with that, before I start, I see we have a new member today. My understanding is Representative Quam is going to be leaving our committee after today. And how do you say your name? Tama?
Tice, yes.
Tama Tice. Tama, Representative Tama Tice is the new member on the committee. Today, technically, you're not you can listen, and it's good to be here because this is probably going to end up going into next week, so you get the background on it. But after that, but as of today, Representative Quam is still on the committee, so he'll be the voting member, and some of this has to do because of the special elections that went on. And if you want to introduce yourself so we know who you are and a little bit about yourself, we all did this the first meeting we were at, so.
Okay.
Pull the microphone down, yeah.
My name is Tama Tice, and I'm from Central Minnesota, District 14A, and my husband and I have had a remodeling company for the past 28 years, and I've been a resident of St. Cloud for 33, which is how long Greg and I have been married. So became very interested very quickly in taking this position, and I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
And we have another new member over here that was the other day, Ben, Representative Lean. You want to introduce yourself and for the committee? And
yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Lean. I'm from District 4A, which is Moorhead. And new to the committee, not quite a voting member, but happy to be here.
You're a voting member as of today.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
A little juggling going on, but that happens when things change and we get after the special elections. Anyway, Representative Norton, I'll move House File 409 to be passed and re-referred to Capital Investments, and proceed with your presentation, and happy you're here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to give just a brief overview of what is contained in this bill, and then I know because this is a GovOps committee, you're going to want to delve into certain parts of the bill, and then we have some testifiers here, and they'll be able to, I think, answer some of the technical questions that you might have. House File 409, the Destination Medical Center Initiative, provides Minnesota with a major economic development opportunity that will deliver significant benefits, stimulating billions of dollars in private investment, thousands of new jobs, and billions in new tax revenue to the state of Minnesota. Mayo Clinic is currently a world leader in healthcare, the largest private employer in the state of Minnesota, and provides billions in economic impact to our state's economy. Mayo's position as a global medical destination is a reality, but sustaining this position is not. Without continued growth and innovation, without private investment, and without the public infrastructure necessary to support the growth, Mayo Clinic and Minnesota will lose their competitive position as a global medical destination. Before you today is a plan to secure Rochester and Minnesota as a medical destination for patients throughout the country and world into the future, and to drive significant economic and job growth over the next 20 years. Plans for Mayo Clinic to invest in excess of $3 billion of Mayo's private capital in Minnesota to expand the needed buildings and facilities throughout Rochester are part of this plan. $2 billion in additional private investments to support patients and visitors and employee demand for lodging, housing, retail, hospitality, recreation, and other enhancements are parts of this bill. Approximately 25,000 to 30,000 new direct permanent jobs will be created over 20 years from the expansion of Mayo Clinic and other business-related activities. Estimates are for the creation of 1,800 to 2,200 construction jobs per year as a result of this initiative. Hundreds of thousands of new patients and visitors will travel to Rochester, Minnesota each year. And you'll hear a little bit about what we currently bring to Minnesota. This is in addition to that. Approximately $3 billion in new tax revenue will be generated to the state and local governments. And Mayo Clinic will aggressively work to retain in Minnesota the new businesses that emerge from Mayo's extensive medical research. The Destination Medical Center public financing component outlined in this legislation is an innovative finance plan. It is new, I want to be clear. Someone asked me earlier, this is new and has not been done before. But it provides a 10-to-1 dollar ratio of private to public investment, as well as a guarantee that no public funding will be provided without proof that tax revenues have actually been generated to the state by Mayo Clinic and the DMC expansion. So let me repeat that. No money will be generated and given out until Mayo has proved that the state has grown as a result of their $3 billion investment. That investment of $585 million from the public, from the state, that public investment will be made over a 20-year period, and it will be made in public infrastructure and improvements that support the growth of employment, visitation, and spending in the market. And just to kind of put a fine point on that, as Rochester grows as a result of this expansion, our city is going to have to respond to that growth. And this is going to be a very rapid growth in a very short period of time, and that's why we're asking for your help. This 20-year multi-billion dollar Destination Medical Center plan represents one of the largest economic development initiatives in the country and will deliver significant benefits to Minnesota, including thousands of new jobs and billions in new tax revenue. So I thank you for allowing me to bring this bill to your committee. I know you're going to have questions about the government operations portion of this, but I think, Mr. Chair, if you would be willing to have some of our testifiers come down, and then we could ask questions, because they will probably be the ones that will help me answer them.
Okay, and that's what I'd plan on doing, have the testifiers first before we take up any of the amendments that were posted. So, the first person on my list is Dr. Patricia Simmons. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Patricia Simmons. I'm a physician at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Thank you, Chair Nelson, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, for the privilege of talking with you and discussing the bill that Representative Norton has brought forward. This is an extremely exciting, perhaps unique, economic development project for Minnesota, and I'm proud to be here and represent Mayo Clinic's views and interests in this. Mayo Clinic, throughout our history, has been a place, a destination, a place of hope and a place of healing. We have people who come from all 50 states, from 145 countries. We want to retain that ability to be the destination medical center that we are, so people can come from all over the world to Minnesota. In order to do that, we have to accommodate them and meet their needs. Our primary value is that the needs of the patient come first. Since their time extends well beyond the walls of Mayo Clinic, we need to create an environment where not only our patients and their accompanying people can be safe, happy, pleased to be here, but a good environment, of course, for our employees. 500,000 people come to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester each year to be a patient, unique individuals. They bring two or three companions, so we have 3 million visitors generated by Mayo Clinic to Minnesota each year. As we've looked at what we need to do to retain our position as a destination medical center, we know we need to invest, and we want that investment to be in Minnesota. We're in league with Minnesota. We love being here, and we hope that people want us here, because not only do we offer help and healing, but we are a major component of the state's economy. Mayo is the largest private employer in Minnesota. We have 43,000 employees. Our economic impact on the state is $9.8 billion a year, a portion of which, as you see, is tax revenue. We're pretty big. We account for 4% of the state's gross domestic product. So why is this project important? It's important to Mayo Clinic's future, and we believe important to the state's economic health and future. I thought you might be interested that of our employees who come to Rochester, over 34,000, they come from 59 counties from around Minnesota. So we're kind of glad to be out and about all over the state. I'll put a little bit more substance to what the increase in jobs would look like. We estimate that there would be 35 to 45,000 new jobs created in Minnesota. Of those, 14 to 16,000 would be Mayo Clinic positions as scientists, physicians, allied health staff, researchers, educators. The economic impact to the state, we calculate, would be significant at about $3 billion incremental dollars beyond what we currently do contribute. This project, we believe, is so important for our future and the state's future. What we hope you will see and like about it is we're willing to put $3.5 billion into this project, leverage an additional $2 billion of private investment, and we ask the state to help support the urban development that will be necessary to support this kind of growth. We've tried to create a scenario that we believe is so low risk for the state. We have to prove our performance before the state invests the money from what we generate in incremental revenue. But we need to know that the state will be there for this project to succeed. I thank you very much for your attention and hope that I can do justice to your questions.
Any questions for the testifier? Okay. The next person on my list is Mayor Ardell Breed.
Brady,
okay.
Good, thank you. Thank you, Representative Norton. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Ardell Brady, the mayor of the City of Rochester, Minnesota. City of Rochester has been working closely with Mayo Clinic and other community leaders in our city and our region to develop a plan that we think will further establish our state as a global leader in healthcare for the future. The community is enthusiastic and supports the DMC vision and the proposed structure outlined in the legislation. We believe it is critical for the city to have the proper level of representation on the authority board to ensure the various economic development projects involved in the DMC align with our master plan and the vision for the city. However, we believe the diverse makeup of the authority board, with members also appointed by the county, the governor, and the legislature, will ensure the DMC vision is carried out in a way that benefits the entire state of Minnesota. Additionally, it is important to note that the authority will follow all public notification and open meeting rules as required of public bodies. The city will be supporting the DMC financially. Approximately $60 million of the proposed $585 million in public costs will be financed locally through an extension of the Rochester City sales tax and employing other local financing tools such as revenue bonding, tax abatement, and TIF, tax increment financing. We've already got skin in the game. In November, Rochester voters approved by a 2-to-1 margin approximately $20 million in sales tax revenues specifically to support DMC. The economic impact from drawing new patients and visitors to Rochester each year will positively benefit Olmsted County and the state of Minnesota as a whole, generating a significant boost to our state's economy, creating thousands of jobs and billions in new tax revenue. We've got a strong coalition of community organizations, local government, businesses, and others who are committed to the DMC and to the successful passage of this finance plan and structure. We are ready to work with the state and other key players to make this a reality in Minnesota. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And any questions of the mayor? Be a quiet committee today.
Thank you.
Next I have on my list Mike Crane from Southeastern Building Trades.
Hello, Mr. Chair. It's Mike Cron.
Mike Cron, okay.
Yep. And hello, committee members. My name is Mike Cron. I am currently, my position is the Southeast Minnesota Building and Trades President. Little background, I have just over 35 years in the construction industry, spent a lot of those years working for the Mayo Clinic. I'm here on behalf of the members that I represent in support of this bill. and Destination Medical Center. The Mayo Clinic and the Building and Trades have had a long history of partnering to build Mayo and Rochester, and really all of southeastern Minnesota is what it is today. In fact, as we speak, our members are working on three major projects at the the clinic's accounting for 1 million work hours and at least $30 million in wages alone. Our members are eager to get going on the next phase of this partnership and the Destination Medical Center. Through one of our other meetings, it was struck on two different perspectives, talking about the retired members and how they've built the Mayo Clinic, and looking on to the younger members are excited about the future that this brings for our membership. And when I say jobs, I mean careers. It's very unique to work for the Mayo Clinic on a construction perspective, and we consider it a career, not just a job. These are good jobs with health insurance, pensions, and that build strong families and a strong middle class. With the estimated 1,800 to 2,200 construction jobs each year from DMC, this is an investment in Minnesota that will pay dividends for years and years to come. In closing, I'd just like to say that we are 100% behind this and we support the bill. Thank you for your time.
Are there any questions for Mr. Cron? Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
The next person I have on my list is Bob Dunn. And I see two of them, so please.
I'm Bob Dunn.
Yeah, I realize that. Please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
I'm Bob Dunn, president of the Hammes Company. We're the lead consultant with Mayo Clinic on the Destination Medical Center. With me is Lynette Crandall. Lynette is with the Dorsey firm. They've been our legal counsel on the DMC project. Our technology is down here. Good morning. Thank you. Dr. Simmons and Representative Norton gave you a good overview of the Destination Medical Center project and the impact that it will have on the state economically. I think the one factor that we point to that probably best defines what will drive the infrastructure need in Rochester is the projected growth in visitation. Dr. Simmons mentioned today that roughly 3 million visits are generated in Rochester every year that come to the Mayo Clinic, both patients, caregivers, and then the associated travel that occurs because of the Mayo Clinic. As a result of the DMC initiative, we expect that those visits will grow to somewhere between 6.5 and 7.5 million visits a year. Well, if you thought about any community in America that saw an increase of 2 to 3 times the visitation in that community, you can imagine the impact that would have on the local infrastructure that's needed to support that level of growth and visitation. And that's what brought us to the DMC initiative. When we began working with the Mayo Clinic, it was very clear that Mayo's strategy for growth is absolute. In order for Mayo to continue to be the world's leading destination medical center, the clinic has to grow. Growth means a substantial investment, billions of dollars of capital investment that the clinic would like to seed in Rochester. That translates to jobs. What Mayo asked us to do is to work to find a way to formulate a partnership that can address the things with this type of growth plan that Mayo cannot do. Mayo and no private interest can build the infrastructure, the core city infrastructure, that is needed to support this type of initiative. If we were talking about growth and visitation of, 30, 40, 50,000 visits a year, the city could normally absorb that with its growth and infrastructure based on its current planning. But the growth is so overwhelmingly impactful on the local infrastructure base that we need a means to close that gap, to make sure that all of the things that it will take to create a world-class destination will occur in Rochester in parallel with the investment that the Mayo Clinic will make. So that's just sort of a context of what we're dealing with. Growth in visitation from 2.5 to 7.5 or 8 million visits a year. That's phenomenal growth, almost unheard of in this country today. So to get there, This time I'll try not to take us out of the realm of our technology. We've put together a plan that is very different than what we typically see on these large economic development initiatives. And I think the graphic behind me explains it quite well. The concept here is a partnership of a private and public interest coming together to create a significant economic development driver that will generate substantial new taxes to the state. And unlike the way these efforts normally go, where the capital investment is made on the front end, your dollars go in on the front end in hopes that private investment will occur, in hopes that jobs will be created, for the hope of realizing new tax dollars. Mm-hmm. We've completely reversed that trend here. The approach that we're taking here is it starts with private investment. Private investment will generate new jobs. And we're not talking millions. We're literally talking about billions of dollars of private investment and thousands, tens of thousands of new jobs. Obviously, those new jobs will generate a very significant amount of new taxes to the state of Minnesota. Only when that has occurred, private dollars, new jobs, new taxes, and those new taxes can be certified on the tax rolls of the state, only then are we able to draw a small percentage of that to then begin to build the infrastructure that will be needed to attract additional private investment, additional new jobs, additional new taxes for the state. So it's a cycle. But the cycle is broken the minute that the new taxes are not certified by the state. It's effectively a way of mitigating your risk in making this investment. And that's a very unique approach. We do a lot of this in a lot of different places, and I've yet to see someone that was willing to come forward and say, our dollars will go in first, our jobs will be created, we will deliver to you new taxes, and only then will we ask for your participation to help us build the infrastructure that will cause us to invest more money, new jobs, more taxes. So it's a very unique approach. We've not seen it before. There are elements of what we're doing here that are built on the same kind of public finance and governance structure that you've done many times in the state. But what's unique here is we're trying to reverse the cycle of how this type of economic development initiative is normally done. And the last point that I'll go to before we talk about the structure is as we go forward, what we've been able to do is put together a framework where we can demonstrate, Dr. Simmons said it earlier, the proof of the growth in taxes. And what this graphic represents, the blue line, is the forecasted new tax dollars to the state of Minnesota caused by this private investment. And it's a massive amount of new taxes over time. Just in the window of time that we've forecasted the build-out of the DMC, you will generate over $3 billion of net new taxes, over and above the dollars spent to pay off the $585 million. So it's true net. After your investment is paid off, you will realize $3 billion of new taxes to the state of Minnesota. What the red line represents is the payoff of the $585 million over time. So you can see the gap that's being generated there is we're generating $10 in taxes for every dollar that's going to pay off the build-out of the $585 million of public infrastructure. Normally, when we see these kinds of projects come together, these big economic development initiatives, that relationship is about 1-to-1. It's a very unique element of this proposal as well. The return, the fiscal impact generated here is way beyond what we would normally see for this type of initiative. So those are sort of the structural elements that build up the plan. We've spent a considerable amount of time to the point of your committee focusing on how can we put together an organizational model that will give us the greatest chance of success in realizing the vision of the DMC. We've looked at various authority structures, governance structures that you use here in Minnesota, and we've looked at a number of approaches that have been used elsewhere. And we think we've found a path that does what I said. It gives us the greatest opportunity for success, meaning creating the greatest number of jobs and attracting the greatest amount of private capital that we can. And very quickly, because I'm sure we'll get into this in questions, what we have looked to do is to cede the control with the state and a public authority, just like the other public authorities that you have around the state. That is where the control is vested as it relates to how these dollars, what these dollars can be invested in, and when these dollars will be invested. You, the public, the state, has total control over the flow of dollars. We recognize, for a lot of different reasons, that that's going to be an absolute. You must control the purse strings. Beyond that, we also know that we have to have a means to effectively see the development of a project like this, see it go forward over a period of time, dealing with a wide array of different issues that will come into play. That's more the day-to-day work on the ground to see this project come together. And that's where we've come up with the concept of a private, not-for-profit economic development corporation, much like you would have in almost any community around Minnesota, whose sole purpose is to drive the mission of the DMC. And there's sort of two practical realities there that we spent a lot of time talking about. One are just the normal day-to-day functional elements of advancing a project like this. My company represents you on the Viking Stadium. We are your advisor at the Sports Authority. That model works very well in many respects, and I would say it works particularly well when the mission of an organization like that is defined by a single project, in this case the development and operation of a sports venue. Where we see a little bit of difficulty with respect to the DMC is the DMC is a very vast, very broad, very complex project. As an example, we will have to market the DMC, Rochester and Minnesota, as a destination worldwide. We need an organization that has the capacity to be effective, you know, in an economic development environment all over the world and convince people that they want to bring jobs and bring investment here to Minnesota. That is not something that naturally fits inside of traditional economic development entities. It's a very unique, very challenging responsibility that has to be taken on here for this effort to be successful. And there's a variety of things like that. The last point that I'll make is one of the opportunities that we have with the DMC, which is vitally important to our collective success over time, is we believe that we can attract a substantial amount of private capital into the mission of the DMC. What I mean by that is we need an economic development corporation that will give us the ability to attract and draw in private capital, anything from benefactor capital to investment capital. We have to have a means to do that. Normally, economic development entities don't have the ability to draw in that type of capital. We have to be careful that no matter how we structure this, that we do not limit our ability to meet that objective, because we're talking about very easily, I think, tens of millions of dollars. We believe it will be hundreds of millions of dollars of additional capital that we can attract here if we have the means to do it. So we've tried to be very careful in how we've thought through the structure and organization of the DMC, guided by one simple and important point. We want this to be structured in a way that our chances of success are the greatest. That's our brief presentation. I don't know if there's anything more that council would like to add.
Representative Winkler, you have a question.
Ms. Finish first. That's fine.
No, please, Representative Winkler. Go ahead.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dunn, I think you're probably the best person to ask about some of the jobs numbers that have been presented here, would be my guess. Could you just summarize for us again and maybe break out the difference between construction jobs, ongoing jobs directly for Mayo, and spinoff jobs that relate to that, and over what time period those jobs are created?
Certainly.
Done.
We generally talk about new jobs, you know, in the neighborhood of 35,000 new jobs over time. So that's in total. Over time, I would say over time is 20 years. So if I break that down over a 20-year period of time, you know, I would average it out. So you're talking about, you know, something approaching 2,000 new jobs every year. And those will be sustained over time. Those aren't quite the same as construction jobs. Within that 35,000 jobs, we have included in the 35,000 about 1,800 to 2,000 construction jobs that will be created that in effect become permanent because of the volume of construction activity that we're going to see. So of the 35,000 in total, I would argue that roughly 2,000 of the 35,000 are new permanent construction jobs that will be generated in the Rochester region as a result of the DMC.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dunn, of the remaining 33,000 jobs over that time period, can you break that out in terms of Mayo versus, I mean, I'm guessing you have local retail, food service, all sorts of ancillary economic support for the clinic.
That's right.
Mr. Dunn.
And Dr. Simmons touched on this earlier, as did Representative Norton. That remaining pool of jobs is split about equally between Mayo-generated jobs and ancillary jobs that are the result of the fact that we're going to see such significant growth in the community. And you touched on the type of jobs that we're looking at. It will be everything from service economy jobs. We anticipate that we'll see more manufacturing type jobs if we can attract medical technology and those types of businesses. But it'll be, as you'd expect, with any growing community, it will be a broad cross-section of jobs. I can't cite the exact breakdown, but I could give you a detailed breakdown of exactly what type of jobs over what period of time. But it's split about equally between clinical and community-based jobs. The one point that I would make, though, is outside of the clinical number, within the remaining, call it 15, 17,000 community jobs, a good portion of those jobs we envision to be like the clinical jobs. Professional level, high wage, industry-based jobs that will spawn off of growth of the medical center. As an example, in Cleveland, with the Cleveland Clinic, they have developed a very significant technology park that lives alongside the Cleveland Clinic. They've generated thousands of jobs that are not clinical jobs, but they're there because of the Cleveland Clinic. We anticipate there will be a considerable amount of job growth in those sectors as well.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dunn, can you provide us with what your estimate is for average wages in the non-clinic jobs?
We can certainly do that. I don't have that information off the top of my head, but we'd be pleased to provide that to you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler.
Just for members' information, to keep all this in perspective, we're talking about roughly 1,750 jobs per year if you divide 35,000 divided by 20. And the state of Minnesota in December added 9,000 new jobs. So, I mean, it's important to not kind of confuse 35,000 aggregate new jobs over 20 years with the amount of economic activity we generate every week in Minnesota. And so as I'm thinking about this bill and how it's structured, I think we have to kind of keep that in proportion. Mayo Clinic is very important for Minnesota, and the city of Rochester is very important, and it certainly demands strong infrastructure investment for Minnesota to maintain that. But it's just important to not sort of lose our cool heads when we're thinking about the kind of investment and the kind of precedent we're setting in creating this and sort of how this job creation compares to everyday job creation in the total economy of Minnesota.
Mr. Dunn.
Yeah, I think my math is a little bit different. I get to about twice the number of jobs that you calculated, but these aren't all the jobs in the state of Minnesota. If I take 35,000 over 20 years, that's almost 2,000 new jobs every year. Most communities that we work in, this level of job growth, 35,000 new jobs, is a monumental number, and nearly everything we work on today centers on how do we drive new jobs in our local economy. And I have to be honest with you, in this country, I could not identify another initiative of this magnitude driven by a single anchoring element, community anchor, like the Mayo Clinic.
And before we proceed, we have visitors up here today from the Mound West Tonka School District, 10th and 12th graders, and we'd like to welcome you to our committee.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Mr. Dunn, we're not have a debate here. I grant you that this is a single project that is extremely important. But my only point is, if we look at, as policymakers, sort of project by project, and not look at the total whole of the economy, we can sort of lose focus sometimes on the value of investing in things that boost the whole economy versus sort of a project by project basis.
Point taken.
Ms. Crandall.
Mr. Chair, again for the record, my name is Lynette Slater Crandall, and I'm a partner at the Dorsey & Whitney Law Firm. I serve as bond counsel and economic development counsel to Mayo Clinic and a number of other public and private entities across the state. And I do understand that there are a number of questions about the governing board and the structure. And so with that, I'm happy to assist Representative Norton with any of those questions.
Okay. And Representative Pugh.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Dunn, and or potentially Representative Norton. It's all very exciting. The first time that we've seen such a model of a public-private partnership with resource investments coming up front, so I think that's just very exciting. My question has to do with wondering if any consideration has been given to a potential negative impact on any other large regional medical facilities, hospitals. You spoke to quantifying the amount of revenue and tax dollars and whatnot. And I'm wondering how much of this, I'm assuming a significant percentage, will be incremental to the state of Minnesota, but I'm envisioning that there will in fact be customers who choose to go to Mayo who would have otherwise gone to their local regional medical center. So I'm wondering if someone could quantify that.
Dr. Simmons, I see you returned.
I came back. Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you for the question, Representative Pugh. First of all, the intent of this project is to grow our destination out of Minnesota, out of region volume of patients, number one. The investment we make will serve the patients we see from wherever they happen to come from. So I think that's important. But it's not to increase regional local market. That is not part of the strategy. I don't think I can quantitate, other than saying the intent is really that destination from outside market. As we look at the healthcare needs and the marketplace, that's where the opportunity for Mayo Clinic and Minnesota lie.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that response, and I'm certain that nobody can quantify what this might mean. I appreciate the intent, and clearly that is the intent. The most significant amount of business will be coming from, the global market. But there are likely to be some maybe unintended consequences in some way. I'm just wondering if there is, I'm not necessarily even asking for an answer right now, but I think some consideration should be given to allowing regional medical centers, hospitals outside of the Mayo to quantify what impact this potential expansion will have had on their business.
Dr. Simmons.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, Representative Pugh. It may help to put in perspective that over half of the patients who come to Mayo Clinic are coming from outside of Minnesota. And again, that's the intent, is to drive more people from that direction. Our strategy, if you will, in Minnesota is really to help people stay in their communities. Our local strategy in Minnesota has largely been driven in that direction. And so we don't view this as a competitive, really, with other medical institutions in the state. It's external that we're trying to deal with our competition.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who this is for, perhaps Representative Norton. I have some questions about eminent domain, and I see that this is creating a political subdivision of its own, and it says that under subdivision 5 on page 15, it talks about acquiring property an exemption for taxes, and that the authority may acquire by lease, purchase, gift, devise, and condemnation proceedings any land. And in 2006, we passed some eminent domain legislation. I can't remember if you were in or not. That might have been your first term, Representative Norton. And that legislation says, and I've got it in front of me, it's 117.025, that land can't be acquired by eminent domain just for economic development. And I've got the statute in front of me. And I'm trying to understand what the authority would be here. Are we trying to set a new standard? Are we trying to go against what's already in statute? Because it seems like this is, if it's a political subdivision, then it would be open to be able to, under this bill, it would change our current statute, and the authority would be able to go and acquire land.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. And we've actually had quite a bit of discussion about this particular issue, and I will let council talk about a little bit in a little more detail. I will say, as I understand it, in order to have this public authority, it needs to have one of three powers. Taxation, which we're not asking for. I can't remember the second one, but the third one was eminent domain, and you have to have one of those three, and so this is the one that we have, and they can talk about in a little bit more detail why that is necessary, but it is to fulfill law, to fulfill a requirement in order to have a public authority. So that's one of the pieces. Also, I think you rightly raise a concern about eminent domain, and it is not easy to use, and the laws that were passed in 2006 make it even more difficult to use. And so I would say the plan is not to have that be a major part of a major tool for us, but that it does support the infrastructure growth that the city may need should that come into an eminent domain issue come into play. So I'm going to let them talk a little bit more about the legal aspects of why that's in there, because there are three components, and this is one of three that we need to have, and they're the legal people. So,
Ms. Dorsey or Ms. Crandall.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I'm happy to bore you with the legal details. And Representative Norton is correct. Our public body is actually patterned after a court authority in the state of Minnesota, and quite similar to any other economic development authority or housing and redevelopment authority that you might have in your community. That body will be able to issue bonds which will finance the public infrastructure on the front end. We want to be able to undertake the financing at the lowest possible cost to the state and issue tax-exempt bonds. Those would be comparable to the GO state bonds that that MMB issues for other public infrastructure projects across the state. To be able to issue tax-exempt bonds, as Representative Norton noted, under federal tax law, one of the three sovereign powers would be required. And so, as a bond lawyer, that's why the eminent domain power is very important to me. And Representative Pepin, you correctly pointed out that it is very difficult to condemn property in Minnesota and many other states across the country after the Kelo decision, which is when the Minnesota law was amended. That law would be applicable to this public body, just as it would be to your city, your county, your local EDA. So nothing in this legislation attempts to trump that in any way.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton. I'm not sure I feel a lot of comfort by that, because I'm not sure that this wouldn't supersede the bill or the statute that we already have. This looks like an exemption. So perhaps it's not necessary to say, to make it clear that this isn't somehow notwithstanding 117.025, or it's not trying to do that. It just gives me a little discomfort. I don't have an amendment or anything right now, but I worry that this is something that citizens could be upset about if they felt like they could lose their land just because the authority decided it wanted to expand the district. And I do, you can answer that comment on that, perhaps.
Representative Pepin, in Minnesota, a public body has only the powers that it's expressly given. So unlike you or I, we can do anything unless the law says we can't, essentially. That's not the way that a public body can function. So again, this language patterns exactly what a port authority power would be in the state of Minnesota. So again, it just clarifies that it could acquire property by eminent domain, but I do not believe, and perhaps House Counsel can give you some comfort on this as well, but I do not believe in any way it provides any exemption from the eminent domain law, otherwise in statute. And if you would feel more comfortable with us providing some notwithstanding language, I'd be happy to work with House Counsel on that.
Representative Capa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Crandall. I think it's the language that says the authority may acquire by lease, purchase, gift, devise, and condemnation proceedings the needed right title. And to me, that's pretty strong language. And so I don't know, maybe I will talk with our counsel here and find out if that should be clarified a little bit. I do have just some questions, since this is government operations. I just do have a couple of questions, Representative Norton, on the on page 8, the makeup of the board. And on page 811, it talks about how members get appointed, and then it says for subsequent terms, the term is 6 years. So looks like they get appointed, and then they're on there for 2 years, and for an initial term of 2 years, and then it says for subsequent terms, the term is 6 years. Is that for all of the appointments, or I wasn't sure which terms. So if you're appointed for 2 years, the Speaker Thiessen makes his appointments, Governor Dayton makes his appointments, they're there for 2 years, and then they're reappointed for 6 years. Is that correct? Or
Mr. Chair?
Representative Norton.
Thank you. We do have an amendment up there that clarifies that, and perhaps this would be a good time for the chair to...
That'd be the A4 amendment. And there's do we want to put that on now, or?
Well, maybe she could explain.
Representative Norton, can you explain the A4 amendment?
Well, this isn't my amendment, Mr. Chair, but it was something that we have talked about together that delineated a little more specifically who is on the board and how they get there, and it does have a whole section on terms, and it does delineate the specific folks that are on that board and what their term is. And so, as I recall, there is a statement about the legislators, and I'm looking at line 2.15, for the legislative appointee, if the member ceases to serve in the legislature, that creates a vacancy. And so we have been even more specific in this this amendment.
And Representative Norton, I think I heard in Representative Pepin's question, are these going to be staggered terms? Looking at the bill, it says for 2 years and the governor, and then they're going to be 6 years thereafter. So is that, so there are staggered terms on the board? Is that...
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, yes, again, this was modeled, I believe, again, identically after the Port Authority law. So subsequent members would serve six-year terms, and they would have staggered terms. There are provisions, though, for vacancies. So, for example, if the mayor were no longer the mayor of the city and served on the board, then that would be a termination provision. But again, the A4 amendment, in talking with House Research, that language has been clarified just very clearly, reflecting the fact that certain of these positions are ex officio. The other thing that the A4 amendment does is that the appointees of each body of the legislature would be non-voting members, and that's the difference in the makeup of the board then.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, so just to clarify then, the members would be appointed for 2 years, and then the subsequent appointment would be for 6 years for all the members on the board, and then I didn't see it here as my quick read-through, can it go on indefinitely? Is there a term limit on how long they can be on this authority?
Representative Pepin, there are not term limits, no.
So they could be on forever? And then, thank you for that clarification. I'm not sure that I like that, but my next question would be, on line 8.18, it says members must be compensated as provided in section 150575, subdivision 3. I didn't get a chance to review that. What is the compensation?
Representative Pepin, is that the $35 a day, Council? I believe 55. So again, that would be a provision that's applicable to your local EDA HRA Port Authority. Not original drafting there, Representative Pepin.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to thank the testifiers. I might have a little different view and understanding of this since I grew up in the area, and I remember when Mayo was much smaller. Most members might not realize it's, you know, over 150 years old in existence, and that I've seen the continued growth in traffic. We don't have the traffic jams that you may in the metro, but we have several highways that have tens of thousands of trips in and out daily, so there's quite a bit of activity. One of the things I noticed is that even when the state had pauses in its growth, Mayo and Rochester have continued to have a steady growth. You know, you think of construction jobs as being temporary, but when Mayo spends tens or hundreds of millions of dollars each year in construction, I don't remember not seeing a crane or two, you know, in the city, and the skyline has grown and changed. My old district grew 33%. It was the 10th fastest growing house district, and when they redistricted, lost 9,000 people. You know, it just shows that there's a history here, and the confidence. I tend to be one of the more skeptical in proposals where a private entity comes in and says we're going to invest, but I've seen in my short lifetime continual investment, conservative investment that basically has proven through decades and generations. So I have a little more confidence in proven history and track record. But I know that there's some concern about how this would impact other medical facilities, hospitals, etc. I remember seeing princes and kings and leaders of countries flying into the airport, presidents. So, you know, I grew up being used to seeing foreign dignitaries and world leaders come in. But I think, and I'm not sure who on the testifiers could say just how many hospitals in different locations in the state of Minnesota, and then how many clinics across Minnesota are part of the Mayo network. So we could have an understand that, you know, regional hospitals, while many of those regional hospitals close that would be affected, are already part of the Mayo health network.
Mr. Hammes, but before I say that, Representative Quam, the chair is going to caution you. I have a bias about people calling construction jobs temporary jobs because they're not. But Mr. Hammes, you can go on.
I would agree with that point. I'm gonna have someone pull out a page for me so I can give you the an understanding of Mayo's footprint throughout the state. You know, in Rochester, we have 34,000 jobs, and statewide that number is quite a bit higher. So the Mayo footprint is throughout the state of Minnesota, generally speaking, not all concentrated just in Rochester. And to sort of build on your point, Representative Quam, and truly put this in perspective, in Cleveland right now, since 2008, they have seen a nearly $6 billion investment in this type of economic development plan. The last 5 years, during the worst economic trough of our lifetime, with a similar initiative, Cleveland has seen an investment roughly equaling what we're forecasting over a 20-year period of time. So I think we're being highly conservative, as Mayo to your point, has historically been a very conservative organization. But I don't think there's a lot of loftiness in our forecasting, proven out by the fact that a similar entity pursuing a similar economic development plan has seen that result in a quarter of the time that we forecasted.
Representative Quad.
Thank you. I was looking more towards, you know, Fairmont and Mankato, Austin, Albert Lea, you know, surrounding hospitals that are actually part of Mayo. And then I think there are dozens of clinics in small towns across, you know, this part of the state, as in from here and south.
Dr. Simmons?
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Representative Quam. I think I can answer, I hope, to your satisfaction. Yes, Mayo has developed a community-based regional primary and secondary care network, predominantly across southeastern Minnesota. And there, I can get you the map and show you, but yes, it extends almost to the South Dakota border going west. That is a really different approach, and that, again, is driving and keeping more patient care in those communities using Mayo Clinic in Rochester when people need that second opinion or very high-end care. We have the numbers, and we can get them to you quantitatively. That would be helpful.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Doctor. It would be nice for the committee to maybe have some of that, you know, the maps and the raw data to, you know, help either set at ease or understand the impact. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, when I haven't done a lot of traveling across the world, but when I've been in Japan and in Europe, you know, when I say where I'm from and Minnesota, some people, but when you say Mayo Clinic, more people realize that. I mean, the branding of the Mayo Clinic is like Disneyland and Coke, and you grab a tissue and how many people call it a Kleenex. And what this project does is protect one of the largest name brands in the state of Minnesota across the world. And as you, you know, have pointed out in some of those materials, Cleveland Clinic and Johns Hopkins and others and those across Europe and Asia are trying to catch up and take that. And I remember as a young kid, you know, American auto industry was the world leader, and they just sat on it. They didn't invest in infrastructure and some of the upkeep to improve, and they were passed. They were passed by other companies in the world. And I don't think Minnesota can afford to neglect the infrastructure and the importance of a worldwide name brand. And so when you're looking at this, don't look at it as your normal economic development of, well, they're going to locate in Minnesota, maybe in this town or that town. Look at it, this here is a something you can't snap your fingers, you can't build a, you know, centuries-old name brand, a worldwide name brand. So once you lose it, you may never get it back, and certainly not easily. So we should give it the appropriate stature when we consider. And one thing I've learned is that Mayo is innovative in using the systems that are available. So taking the Port Authority and that structure and utilizing it for a destination. Think of Las Vegas. That's a destination world-renowned that brings in billions of dollars economic activity. Mayo is, I think, a kinder, friendlier version of that. It's a destination that saves lives and does good things. And I don't think we have any of the negative impacts. So I just wanted to make sure that if anyone had any questions, I could help out with, but let people know, as someone that grew up in the area, that this is not a trivial or flash in the pan operation, and it never has been.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick areas I want to visit with, and one is to the author of the bill, Representative Norton. Thank you for bringing this forward for the legislature to consider. The map behind you reinforces what my thoughts were after I had visited with the folks from Mayo earlier this week, and that would be that on the structure and the oversight board that you consider maybe having somebody who is a not inside baseball type person from the Rochester area. As I look at some different ideas and proposals on here, maybe we'd have somebody from greater Minnesota. When I say greater Minnesota, we usually think the metro area, but outside of the Rochester. Maybe somebody from Duluth or somebody from Brainerd or St. Cloud or what have you, who can just be that, have you thought about, because it is such a statewide influence that may be beneficial in taking it out of the core of Rochester. So I just ask you to contemplate that in your structure, proposed structure on that.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we certainly have had some talk about that, and because the governor does have the possibility of appointing someone in the construction industry, that person actually, it says from a statewide organization, it could be someone outside of the community, but I understand your concern, and we'll continue to talk about that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Norton, it might even be somebody who's involved, as we're specifying in the trades in one of the amendments here, it might be somebody who's involved in the medical outside of the greater Minnesota, or out of the Mayo footprint, so that they could provide some feedback as to what kinds of services they may need, just to have that kind of grassroots connection. The second question that I would have, and I think Mr. Dunn might be able to answer this question for me, the types of jobs that we were talking about bringing in, Representative Dorholt, Representative Tice, and myself are all from the central Minnesota area, and one of the things that we see and hear from the health providers from the CentraCare group is that every physician that is hired brings 4 to 5 other highly trained technicians or clinicians to support that practice. And I was just wondering if you could quantify within the jobs that you were talking about, that 1,750 to 2,000 a year, how many might be those higher paid physicians and the clinicians and technicians that would come in? And the question becomes, even though there may be fewer jobs per month per year that are being generated, that are much higher income paying jobs, so therefore the state of Minnesota may generate more of a direct benefit because of the wage structure that's and salary structure on those than they might from some of the other jobs. Maybe just can respond to that, if you would, for just a moment.
Dr. Simmons or Mr. Dunn, if you would like.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative, for the question. I think we'd like to share in the answer, if we may. I want to comment about these jobs. Yes, this isn't just physician growth, but it is high-level, these are high-level jobs. It's a little different than just the more retail entertainment industry that some public investments result in. The other piece of this that I think is so important to highlight is that Mayo Clinic invests $600 million in research every year. That research generates discoveries. Those discoveries certainly go into improving people's lives and health. They also improve the economy. We want to create more new businesses from our discoveries in Minnesota. Of all the companies that our discoveries have led to, most of them are outside the state because there hasn't been a nucleus. And part of these jobs really represent some of that new business growth surrounding our research in Minnesota. Mr. Dunn.
Mr. Dunn.
Thank you. I just had a couple of points to Dr. Simmons' comments. Factually, to your question of, what percentage are high-wage, professional-level jobs, better than half. The other point that I would make, though, unlike almost any of these big economic development projects, the diversity of these jobs is very unique. Better than half are in the high-wage professional categories, but this covers the full spectrum of jobs. And people ask me at times, are these good jobs, not good jobs? A job is a good job. What's nice here is we'll touch all corners of the population in that region and generate jobs that can suit every level of the wage scale.
Thank you. Mr. Driscoll. Further questions? Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, so did you say at the beginning that we're going to come back to this bill another day if we don't move through it quickly enough?
Representative Winkler, yes. I think we have scheduled at 10 after Representative Runbeck's bill, and I don't think we're going to be able to get through all the amendments by then. And I think we need to flesh out some more about the the structure of this, so it looks like we'll be coming back on with this bill on Tuesday.
Okay. Mr. Chair, my just request to Mr. Dunn would be a detailed breakdown of the job projections, including projected salaries, et cetera.
Be happy to provide.
Yeah. Okay. And Representative Pepin, you had some more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have I have an amendment that I was going to do as an oral, but I'm wondering if would you, if since we're hearing this on Tuesday, if I would still have time to submit it. It just has to do with the eminent domain and to just clarify that language a little bit.
Why don't you get it drafted, and I think we'll have time to get it, and we'll accept it for Tuesday.
Thank you very much. That's all.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know more about the acquisition of property and how that works in the plan. If you could kind of walk through how that happens. I've been reading the section in the bill, or the sections in the bill, about that, about the development of the district and the ratification by the city council and some other parts about it. I read the part on page 9, though, that raises a question. The authority also has the power to finance activities outside of a medical center development district. So I'm kind of curious about could you walk through kind of the district itself, the development of it, what it will look like, how it could change over time, that type of thing.
Mr. Dunn.
There's a number of questions there that I'll try and pick off one at a time. The creation of the development district will come subsequent to the development of a development plan. So the authority will have a development plan created that will define the boundaries of the district, and that will get adopted at the authority level. Once that district is defined and adopted, we then know the geographic footprint inside of which the public investment will occur. If I understood your question, it relates also to, can there be investment outside of that development district? And what we've tried to anticipate is, I'll make up an example. Let's say a major medical pharmaceutical company says they want to come to Rochester, but they can't locate downtown. It gives us the ability to create sub-districts, which would, in effect, be an amendment to the originally created district to allow for that type of investment to occur outside of the original boundaries of the district as we establish them.
Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. So if there is a change, if the authority makes a change in the district, will they have to go back again for reapproval to the city in order for the city to and the taxpayers to have a look at that?
That's correct.
Mr. Dunn.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to lay this bill over for Tuesday. So if everyone wants to put their information they've got in their back in their packets, and so we have it for Tuesday, and get our any more amendments planned for that would be great. And thank you for coming, and hope
thank
to
you.
See you back Tuesday. And with that, I will move that House File 155 be removed from the table. And all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. And then I'll renew my motion. Representative Runbeck, if you want to come back down. And Mr. Black, if you want to join her, ask. Generators. Welcome
Thank
back,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you very much. There is an author's amendment.
Yeah, very good. Which amendment is the?
Mr. Chair, I don't have the actual number of it.
The DE1 or the DE2?
The DE2, it would be.
DE2. Okay. So I've moved House File 155 to pass to be placed on the general register. So the DE2 amendment. Can you explain what the amendment does?
Sure, and I think members know the background of the bill, that we're trying to modernize the fee or the price that's charged for a notary public to authorize something. But the amendment would repeal the statute entirely, many states, so that the law would be silent on the actual price that a vendor would charge. But it would require then that in a place of business that the vendor would have to post the price, so that there wouldn't be, you know, a customer would not be unawares, would have received the proper information as to the to what is being charged. And the reason for that, I think, is that we're not talking about a fee in the same sense that a fee goes into the general fund. So it's not like the driver's license fee. This is really more of a price. And the fact that the statute has had $1 in the statute for 25 or 30 years means that we haven't really adjusted to CPI. We haven't taken into account that sort of the people offering the service have changed. There are many sort of office and convenience stores or office store, supply stores, I should say, that have folks available to provide notary publics. We have a lot of banks and legal offices now that only allow their own clients to use those services. They don't want to take the risk. So there's reasons to see that it's modernizing, and we should allow for the fact that there are actually small business people who go through the effort of getting a commission and getting the equipment, getting trained, and so on, so they can have this available for their customers.
Representative Freiberg.
If I'm reading this correctly, as the bill was introduced, it would have just increased the maximum fee from $1 to $5, and this seems like a pretty substantive change. It gets rid of the, you know, any fee limit altogether. Am I reading that correctly?
Mm-hmm. Representative Rudnick.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Freiberg, that is what it would do. And there again, looking to recognize the fact that the service is available now in office supply stores, that sometimes it's requiring the individual to go off-site to actually administer their service. So I think we're saying that there might be, you know, there might be two prices.
Representative Freiberg.
I mean, I guess if this is the form you want the bill in, I'd vote in favor of the amendment. I guess I just do have some concerns having no fee limit there at all. I mean, there are some circumstances where people need to get things notarized. I just went through it to get a birth certificate for my son. I had to notarize the application there, and I just worry in some circumstances it might make it difficult, and it might, I don't know for sure at this point, but it might change my view of the bill.
Mr. Black, where are you on eliminating all the fees? I know they haven't been raised in a while, but where does the Secretary of State office sit on eliminating all the caps?
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Burke Black. I'm the legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State. And regrettably, I'm just now reading the bill, so I guess I would have to say we don't have a position at this time.
Representative Runbeck, I have some concerns about, I mean, the bill in its original form I supported, and I think I continue to support, that's why we're taking it back up. I have some concerns about taking all the caps off, as we've discussed. I think at the last committee we talked about, there's some discussion about, you know, the posting of the fees is a way to do that, but if you drive a long distance in some of the more rural areas to get it notarized and find out it's a large amount of money, it concerns me. So, I mean, I don't know if I personally support the amendment that's there. So, Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair, and I recognize that has been a concern. I think that it's possible to pick up the phone. I mean, if somebody is wondering, if they have to travel 30 miles anyway, they certainly could make a phone call to, you know, the provider to find out what the price is. I mean, people are in the habit of checking prices. And I think I look at this too, is it's not like the purchase of the loaf of bread, you're going to buy it every week, that sort of thing. This is, you know, once in a couple years, you need a notary public.
And Representative Runbeck, that's where I have concern, is because a lot of times when you do need that service, you end up having to do it quickly because now you got to get this notarized, and you're running about. And if you drive 30 miles, you may not pick up the phone to compare prices on something like this. You're going to find out where you can get it done, and if you get there and it's a exorbitant fee, you're going to have to pay it because you're under the gun. If like last year, and we had to get the certify that our pendants, that you may have to get that notarized, and now you got to get it done. You're in a short time frame. So I guess I have concerns about, again, myself personally, concerns about taking the total fees off altogether. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess brings up a concern or question I have, too. So let's say that you have a business in a remote part of the state, small community, that requires the documents be notarized on a fairly regular basis. There's one shop in town that offers a service, so they decide to charge $20 for notarization. So it may not be the individual, but that small business then that has to have their documents notarized 5, 10, 15, 20 times a day for different individuals, would end up paying quite exorbitant fees. So I caution that we don't overstep what we're trying to accomplish here.
Representative Mr. Black.
Representative Falk and members, I would simply note in a case like that, one would think that market forces would dictate that the $140 fees, total fees, and then maybe another $30 for the stamp, that it would be a good thing for that company to invest in having one of their employees become a notary public. Notary publics cannot notarize their own signature, so you wouldn't want it to be, if you've got a one-person shop, that might be an issue. But if you're having that kind of frequency of things being notarized, that is an investment that you might want to consider.
Representative Falk.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the point is, some of these small towns, you only have maybe one attorney in town, and they can't serve as their own notary public. So if you only have one other person that does, and they're the only, you know, person to do things like, you know, that type of legal documents, that situation, yes, you could say market forces should bear out, but oftentimes it's things that people don't think of.
Mr. Black.
Well, just one more point, Representative Falk and Mr. Chairman and members, and that's that I just want to make sure people understand you don't have to be an attorney to be a notary public. In fact, most of our notary publics are not. Clearly, there are some standards for notary public services. The notary does have to identify in accordance with the law there, the person who is signing. I mean, there are some things that have maybe legal-like aspects, but you don't have to be an attorney, and generally speaking, anyone who is sophisticated in business probably could fulfill all of that.
Representative Falk?
Understand.
Okay. Representative Freiberg.
I was just going to say, just a quick comment. It sounds like other members share some of my concerns. I was initially inclined to support the amendment, but I think at this point I may not end up doing that, and I'd actually request a roll call.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Runbeck, we do have, I mean, it's not a perfect market situation. We have certain requirements in law that people have various things notarized. It seems to me if we're going to require people to have things notarized, we might set a cap on the amount that they have to pay to get it notarized, not unlike, you know, any other fee that we're essentially requiring. We're creating the notaries, we're requiring that they be used, and by having a cap, you're making sure that it's not terribly expensive. Overall, in my experience, it's not that hard to get something notarized, I live and work in the metro area, and I bank at Wells Fargo, so it's free, and I work at an office where they have it. It just seems to me that, by and large, the notary system that we have works fine, and if we have to adjust up the fee for some small businesses to go from 1 to 5, it's a modest change. I would support that, but the rest of it just seems to me we're kind of engaged in a market experiment when we could just leave it as it is. The nice conservative approach is leave the system alone and make incremental changes.
Representative Wayne O'Driscoll.
Being in the same sentence with Representative Winkler, that's a new one today, but thank you. Just a couple of things, just the way in the background of notaries, as well as Mr. Black was indicating. A financial institution, a government entity, may have employees within that organization who are notaries, and so as clients come in or as citizens come in, they would notarize the signature for business purposes. So it's not a conflict of interest for someone at the City of St. Paul to notarize the mayor's signature who's an employee there. It's simply an affidavit. This is the person who appeared before me and notarizing their signature on that. The bigger concern, I think, is, and I'd like to ask Representative Freiberg this question, did you know when you went to get that birth certificate you needed to have your signature notarized? And I'm doing that kind of as a rhetorical question, because I think most people don't know that they need a notary when they're transacting business. It's one of those things that kind of pops up. And so I go back and forth on let the market decide what's going to happen on here. I believe if you say it's $25, everybody in town is going to only charge $25, and you're going to have a public relations issue because somebody was there. And then the next thing you know, there's somebody else in the business who's at $10 or $7 or whatever the case may be. So you may have this kind of, as the market tries to find its equilibrium on here, on that as well. It seems like we're spending an awful long time trying to decide if it's $5 or no limit on something that's not really generally a problem.
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, just to respond to that. No, I didn't. With my first child, I'm sure I went through it, but you know, you have a lot going on after a child's born, and I forgot about it, and then was reminded abruptly after my second child was born.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll.
And that's maybe the fear that Representative Winkler and others have, is that you're kind of caught between the rock and the hard spot. You've driven X many miles, you're under the gun to get those kinds of things, and that somehow there may be, I don't want to use this term as the motive, but some kind of extortion on a fee for something like that. But I do believe that you will have customer relations issues, and word will get around, just like, boy, this is the place to eat, not to eat, to do business, not to do business, on those kinds of things as well.
Representative Truskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just curious, are we still on the bill, or did the amendment get moved?
The amendment hasn't been moved yet.
Okay. I would have a question for Mr. Black. Mr. Black, what does it cost if, we're having this discussion about where the market is going to go, and nobody would know. I suspect it'll be minuscule, if anything, in terms of movement. But what does it cost, ultimately, if somebody wants to be a notary public themselves?
Mr. Black.
Representative Draskowski, Mr. Chairman and members, the fees are... first of all, the term of a notary public is approximately 5 years, so you have to amortize that out over the course of that. It's a $120 filing fee or application fee with the Secretary of State. There is, on the application, you have to answer certain questions. If your answers raise certain issues, the Department of Commerce does further investigation, but most applicants don't have this issue. Once the commission is issued, and I'll say that notaries public are public officials. They're appointed by the governor with the consent of the other body. Once the commission is issued, there is a $20 fee to file your commission with the county. So we're up to $140 now. Then you do have to provide yourself with a notarial stamp. The stamp, there used to be a notarial seal that people had, a real actual seal. We don't do that anymore. The notarial stamp is highly prescribed in statute. You can get it from various office supply stores. They generally want to see your commission. They want to see the piece of paper that is your commission. And it's about $30, $35 for the stamp. So we're up to $175 now. That should be about the size of it, except for, of course, normal operating expenses. You're going to have to buy an ink pad for the stamp. You're going to have to, it's recommended, but not required, recommended that you keep a journal that shows, if you are the notary, that shows each of the notarial transactions in which you participate, just so that if there are questions at a later time, you can go back and say, oh yeah, this was this, and they identified themselves by showing me their employee ID card at the company or their driver's license, or sometimes they identify themselves to me because I've known them since I was three. You can identify somebody on the basis of personal recognizance. But you're going to want to, generally, you're going to want to keep a record of that. I can't think of any other required costs. There may be some optional costs. There are some notary organizations that conduct training. That would be an extra expense if you wanted to do that. But that's about it.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair, members, it sounds like about $35 a year, you can get in the market of being a notary public, and if it would seem to me a pretty easy for a business or individual or group of individuals to become notary publics and add in supply to the supply and demand of notary public signature capabilities. Mr. Chair, we're kind of spinning here, but I would move the DE2 amendment, and we'll see if it sticks or not, and then we can move forward.
Okay. What's that? No, we didn't move it.
And Mr. Chair, I do have several of the notary publics. Yes. Mr. Chair, I have several here. They've just arrived late, but if anyone has questions of them, they'd be available.
Okay. Any further questions on the amendment?
Yes. Since the amendment hasn't been moved, should I renew the roll call request?
Roll call has been asked for. Any other questions on the amendment? If not, the clerk will take the roll. I'll go first, Jeff.
Nelson?
No.
Freiberg?
No.
Pepin?
Yes.
Dorholt?
No.
Drazkowski?
Yes.
Falk?
No.
Kahn?
No.
Lean?
Nay.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Pugh?
Yes.
Sanders? Quam?
Yes.
Winkler?
No.
Five nays, or five ayes and seven nays. Read it right away. The amendment did not pass. I also have an A1 amendment. Representative Kahn, I believe that's your amendment. About the stamp for ex officio?
Oh, yes. This is an amendment. Thank you. I didn't remember to which bill I was going to put it in. This is an amendment that suddenly changed the practices for state representatives. At one point, every state representative, state senators to other people, are notary publics. And for a while, you didn't use it very often, but we did use it occasionally to do it. Then at some point a requirement was put in to that we then had to have a stamp, which meant we then had to have a stamp that meant if you wanted to do it, there's nothing wrong with this, except if you wanted to use it, you then had to get a new stamp every term, because if you look at it. And so what this does is that this keeps the requirement per stamp, but just then allows a stamp so you can fill in the term each time you do it. I think this would be it's something that was a convenience to be able to do occasionally. Can't remember how many times I did it fairly.
Representative Wanbeck?
Mr. Chair, it sounds like a friendly amendment to me.
Mr. Black, is the Secretary of State okay with that?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, the Secretary of State's office was consulted, and this, I would like to simply point out, if I might, this applies to all of the ex officio notaries, which it's far beyond the simply the legislators. The change to require the stamp was made really more for the other ex officio notaries, because when back in the day, the format that was used without the stamp was not being recognized by unsophisticated consumers of the documents that had been notarized. They didn't realize that this was a legal notarization. And so that's why we required the stamp in the legislation that was passed several years ago. The only thing I would have to say about the stamp that would allow the filling in of the term expiration date is just to get on the record that if you don't fill in that date, the notarization is not valid. So please make sure, if you're going to use this, that you fill in the date on that stamp about when your term expires.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for Mr. Black, very quickly, how would the Secretary's office want to handle a situation where an individual under Representative Kahn's amendment who is already currently a notary and may have their five-year stamp but also have the privilege as a legislator? Do you have a preference as to which would be used, or is it whichever the member chooses at the time?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman and Representative O'Driscoll and members, we do not have a preference. You certainly, and I would say for those legislators who have in fact purchased the stamp, you could probably get either the office supply store or maybe somebody else to alter the stamp to take out the date, just cut it out, and then start writing it in. So you don't necessarily, if you bought the stamp with the date on, I don't think you have to buy another stamp with the blank. But we don't have a preference for purposes of the legislators. I think we probably would recommend to the other ex officio members or ex officio notaries. I personally would recommend that they stay with the dates. Many of them, in fact, don't have, because they're appointed to unlimited appointments. For example, the deputy county recorders, they don't have a term, actually. They're continuing. So they say their term is indeterminate, and so they won't have to make any changes at all.
Representative Driscoll. Any more questions? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment to House File 155, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is approved. Amendments adopted. And there's somebody, a witness that wants to speak? Anybody in the audience would like to speak to or against this bill? We're running over a little bit here, so if you can be short.
Good morning.
Please identify yourself for the tape.
And yes, for the record, my name is Randy Jessup. I own two UPS stores, one in St. Paul and one in Roseville. Last evening, I think it was the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, had a similar hearing to what you are today, and they went ahead and that committee approved this bill before you to go forward to the Senate floor. I don't know if you had been communicated that, but there was much discussion there, and they went ahead and approved the bill to move forward on their side of the House.
Mr. Jessup, our motion is to send it to the General Register, which is to the floor. Okay. And Judiciary hasn't requested it, but if they do, once it gets there, we'll send it back there. But our motion is to send it to the floor.
Right.
And there's an A1 amendment, but I understand the A2 replaced that, so don't need to worry about that. Any other questions on the bill? If not, I renew my motion that House File 155 as amended be passed and be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
The ayes have it. Bill's passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Cronbeck. And with that, members, the committee's adjourned.